People who remember the 1960s and the Beatles will remember the name of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. He is the Indian guru who developed transcendental meditation and attracted followers, including the Beatles and the family of our next guest. Claire Hoffman's family followed the teachings of the Maharishi, followed them halfway across the country, this country. Claire's childhood revolved around meditation and related practices. She writes of that period in her book, Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood. Claire Hoffman writes for national publications and worked stints at Rolling Stone and the Los Angeles Times. She holds a master's degree in journalism and, appropriate to her current book, a master's degree in religion. She lives in Los Angeles. Claire Hoffman, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff. I'm excited to talk to you.
So you mentioned that this is a childhood vivid and hopeful, mystical and turmeric-scented. Where was this exactly?
Well, you know, we moved from New York City when I was 5 years old, and we moved to this tiny town in southeastern Iowa called Fairfield. So that is where a lot of the book takes place. And those were, the, you know, Maharishi had bought a bankrupt university in 1972 there and asked people to move from all over the country and be a part of his meditation and peace movement. And so in 1983, that's where my mom moved us.
So you, your mom, and your brother?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's come to the present. What got you looking back at that time with such intensity?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I feel like I moved away from Fairfield when I was 17, and I feel like I'd kind of figured it out. And, you know, the subsequent 10 or so years, I worked as a reporter, and I felt pretty cynical and critical of Maharishi and the movement and, to some degree, the town that I grew up in. And after I had my first daughter, I felt this shift. You know, I felt a lot of nostalgia and a lot of longing for what we had had in Fairfield, you know, this sort of sense of purpose and a sense of magic and meaning. And, you know, as happy as my life was in Los Angeles, I didn't feel a lot of those things.
So, which raises the question, why you went into journalism, given that there is sort of a prevailing, if not cynicism, certainly a required skepticism.
Well, I mean, I have it in spades. It's almost more that I have to balance out the other piece. I mean, I think growing up in Fairfield was at times hard for me because I was definitely always the kid who was critical or asking questions, and that wasn't necessarily encouraged there at the time. And so I loved journalism and the ability to go up to strangers or go to people in power and ask them questions and make them explain what was happening and sort of pull things apart and understand them. I loved that there was a job that allowed you to do that.
See, you got to the questioning later, though. It sounds like you pretty much embraced this early on. I mean, how old were you when you got your mantra?
I was 3 years old when I started meditating.
Wow. And so talk about what it did for you. What did saying the mantra over and over do for you? What did the overall practice of meditation do for you?
I remember really vividly learning to meditate when I was 3 years old. And at that time, you know, we were living in New York, and, you know, my parents' marriage was pretty tumultuous. They had met on a TM retreat, and my mom was really devoted to Maharishi. She had gone to Europe and taken his teacher training program, but my dad, you know, was an alcoholic, he was a writer, and he was really struggling. And so by the time I was 3 years old, when I learned to meditate, he was like sort of barely in the picture. My mom says, you know, the last year that he lived with us, she doesn't even think we saw him because he was just sort of out all the time. And so for me, meditating was this space that gave me a little bit of privacy and a sense of peace away from the tumult of my family. It was also something that I watched my mother do, you know, so twice a day my mom would go into the other room and sit on the couch and, you know, put like an Indian shawl on and sit there and meditate. And she talked about all the things that meditation did for you, that it gave you mental clarity, that it made you more conscious, that it gave you almost sort of superpowers. So as a kid, that was really attractive to me. You know, I mean, every kid wants to have superpowers, and I certainly did.
It sounds like to you as a little girl, your mom was quite the imposing figure when she was doing her meditation.
Yeah, well, perhaps you're referring to the fact that it was like a hard rule in our house that you could not interrupt her when she was meditating. Like she would kind of freak out at us.
Oh boy. Okay, so imposing in that sense too.
Yeah.
So how far did you carry it in your own life? I mean, were you meditating at the time that you began working on this project, working on this book, or had you fallen away from it at any point?
I definitely fell away. I mean, you know, around when I was a teenager, my mom stopped making me meditate. You know, I'd meditation had been sort of like brushing your teeth in our house. It was just something you had to do. And, you know, for the first, like, probably when I was 13 or 14 years old, I would just go into my room and read magazines and eat candy during the 15 minutes that I was supposed to be meditating. Really, really raising my consciousness.
Blood sugar anyway.
Exactly. And so, you know, I mean, by the time I was 16 or 17, I really wasn't meditating very much or sort of sporadically. And when I went away to college and later on to grad school and when I was working, meditation was something that I would come back to really just occasionally, like if I was feeling sick or if I wanted to avoid a house guest. You know, I mean, it was sort of like a as needed instead of a regular routine.
So your mom, you mentioned about when you started to break away, stop meditating, moved out at 17. How old were your mom when she first came in contact with the Maharishi?
She was, that's a good question. I think she was 19 years old. And, you know, she had come from the East Coast and from a Roman Catholic family. And her parents had gone through a really awful divorce. And it was a very tumultuous home. And meditation for her was just this like total lighthouse to another realm. And you know, the teachings of Maharishi made so much sense to her, and this sort of consciousness-based philosophy of life, it really connected for her in the late 60s.
We'll talk more with Claire Hoffman about transcendental meditation and her family and following the Maharishi Mahesh Yoga. Claire's book is called Greetings from Utopia Park. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you may do so. Back on the Exchange with Claire Hoffman and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the journalist Claire Hoffman, writing about herself in a memoir called Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood. She and her family were followers of the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who trademarked the term transcendental meditation. They ended up living near the yogi's site in Iowa. Fairfield, Iowa, of all places, was the center for activity for the TM folks. And that's where Claire and her family lived as she was growing up. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760. If you have some memories of the Maharishi and his involvement with the Beatles at all. And you can join us by email as well, jx@jeffnet.org. Help people, Claire, understand the appeal of the Maharishi and how widely loved and respected he was at his peak.
Yeah, I mean, TM has interestingly had two big sort of moments. And the first one was with Maharishi in the 60s and early 70s. There was a point where Gallup conducted a poll in the early 70s where something like 5 or 6% of Americans had learned to meditate, learned his form of meditation, transcendental meditation. He was, you know, he was this big, big pop culture figure. He was on the cover of Life and Time. He was sort of the guy who brought meditation to, you know, to the West and popularized it and had this idea that you could just be a regular person who meditated. You didn't have to transform your life or become a different person. You could kind of, you know, meditate and go to the bank, probably would be Maharishi's ideal. So, you know, he was absolutely loved. And then, you know, in the mid to late 70s, there was this real shift, and he introduced this new form of meditation, it wasn't new, but it was his, like, newly trademarked form of advanced techniques, and he called them the TM City Program, and City, loosely translated, means superpower, and it was kind of much more out there than where he'd been at before. And the big sort of city that he touted was the ability to levitate, to practice yogic flying. And after that, there was a real contraction, and the movement became much sort of smaller and more devoted, and it lost a lot of its mainstream appeal once he asked people to start flying.
Got a little too weird for some people, huh?
It was apparently, although not for my family.
All right, we'll get into that in a bit. So it sounds like your mother was a Beatle lover. I mean, was that part of what was the attraction to the Maharishi? If the Beatles loved him, then she should too.
Yeah, I mean, it's always kind of fascinated me because my mom loved the Beatles so much, and she had all their albums, and she was just a total fan. But, you know, I mean, as pretty much most people know, the Beatles had a falling out with Maharishi, and that just never really bothered her.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, she just, and it's true, I mean, it's not just my mom, it's most people who live in Fairfield and who you know, sort of followed Maharishi's call to arms, if you will. You know, they just see the events that happened in Rishikesh with the Beatles as a misunderstanding.
What had been your mother's spiritual tradition before she latched onto the Maharishi and what he was teaching?
You know, not much. You know, she was really young. I think she was 18 or 19. And, you know, I think she had left New Jersey. She was living in Princeton in high school. And, you know, her family was Roman Catholic. And I think the idea of divinity and God was a very sort of judgmental, harsh, and restrictive one. And she went to the University of Colorado, Boulder, and she, you know, moved into a house with a bunch of people, and I think they were probably experimenting with hallucinogenics, and she pretty quickly was attracted to TM and this sort of much more transcendent philosophy of living.
Now, she met your father apparently through TM, is that right?
They met at a TM retreat in Southern California.
You know, I should have asked earlier, what is the difference between meditation and transcendental meditation? What's going on in transcendental that is unlike other kinds of medication?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it is necessarily different than other, the experiences you have are different necessarily. I'm sure the people from the TM movement would say, yes, they are. I don't know that I believe that. You know, there's loosely maybe three different kinds of meditation. There's a mantra-based meditation, and that's what TM is, where you sort of quietly say a mantra in your head. There's mindfulness, where you sort of experiment with, you know, letting your attention go and sort of letting go of thoughts and just, you know, it has no mantra. And then there's, you know, guided meditation, where somebody describes flying over the ancient city of Atlantis or whatever. So, you know, I mean, TM is trademarked by Maharishi, and it's something that costs around $1,000 to learn. There are other very similar products, if you will, to transcendental meditation that are out there for people if they want them.
We were talking to Claire Hoffman about her life growing up around the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's complex in Iowa, and the book is called Greetings from Utopia Park. Deb in Talent writes the question, always had the feeling that the TM mantra was a mystical and secret thing. Would you ask the author to describe that?
Well, it kind of was mystical and secret for me. I just had a friend who learned, and she was describing the process for me. I mean, just this is in the last week, a really good friend of mine. And she was getting ready to say her mantra to me, and I was like, no, you know, please do not say it out loud. And I am, you know, a total cynic and skeptic, but I can't. There is this sort of idea around not saying it out loud. Now, that said, you can Google transcendental meditation mantras, and of course you will find them on the internet. So, like all magical things,
all the secrets are revealed at some point. Right?
Yes, the internet has undone all magic.
Let's talk a little more about your father and your parents' relationship. Your parents met through TM. You mentioned your father's an alcoholic, left when you were very young, which is what really spurred the move to Iowa. You write about the Hoffman curse that your father talked about, though. What was that?
Well, you know, I mean, the reason I wrote about this, I mean, my dad's family you know, for a number of generations just struggled with alcoholism and depression and suicide and abuse. You know, my great-grandmother committed suicide. My great-grandfather committed suicide. It was just this very sort of gothic family line. And, you know, it really weighed on my dad. And, you know, he certainly told us about it, and then it weighed on us in some ways. And the reason I include it in the book and the reason I talk about it is because one of the things that made me want to write the book is this idea that, you know, that we as humans are flawed, and part of that flawedness and that sort of attraction to vice and substances and addiction is, you know, the sense that we don't like our humanity. And I think that is such a direct relationship to what happens when people are attracted to religious movements, you know, and what happened with creating, like, Maharishi as sort of a living God on earth. So what you have is this sense of, like, cursedness or flawedness or, you know, a person with vices, and then you have somebody like Maharishi who is portrayed as holy and pure and enlightened and in a different state of consciousness. And I think, you know, people really project onto that all the things they want to be, and that's really where we get this sort of guru idea from, you know, and all the stuff that goes with it.
You explained that Maharishi Mahesh Yogi ended up buying a defunct college in Fairfield, Iowa. That's what they were doing there. Why, though? I mean, what was it they were hoping to do at that facility?
Maharishi was one of the most ambitious people that you could imagine. I mean, he had a vision for, you know, basically like total world peace domination. And so in the 70s, he had actually just come up with something called the World Plan, and it was to open 3,600 centers of meditation around the world and all the major cities of the world. And the university that he opened in Iowa was just to be the first of many. And it, you know, the Maharishi International University, that's what it was called at the time. And it would teach his philosophy of living and his, you know, sort of prove, you know, the science that proved that his meditation techniques, you know, were creating all this change in individuals and in society. And, you know, I think he really wanted to institutionalize his knowledge. You know, I mean, like any ambitious person, that was his vision of really institutionalizing it and carrying it on and having it go out into the world.
Now, I understand there was a private school on campus, but you couldn't afford to go, so you had to go to public school. And there was a bit of a, what was it called, the gurus versus townies tension in Fairfield?
Exactly. Very footloose. You know, when I got to Fairfield, you know, we moved there from New York, and I just was so excited because I thought that everybody would be meditating and everyone would be on the same page. And, you know, we couldn't afford the Maharishi School of the Age of Enlightenment, which was the name of the grade school. And I went to a public school, and immediately, you know, the townie kids asked, you know, hey, does your mom fly? And I said, oh, no, she doesn't fly, but that's why we're here. She wants to learn to fly. And I was just marked after that, you know, as like a weirdo or weird kid. And, I mean, it's, you know, the town has really transformed. It's different now. But at the time, in the 80s and into the 90s, it was a town divided between the gurus and the townies. And the gurus were sort of people from the coasts, mostly, or Europe, who, you know, were spending 3 to 4 hours a day meditating and, you know, liked pastel colors and organic food and, you know, all the things that are actually kind of mainstream now.
Right.
And the townies were these people who've been there for generations and, you know, had worked in, their families worked in the factories or the farms and were just totally bewildered and some of them very pissed off to have this sort of invasion of, you know, what they saw as weirdos coming into their town.
What was your name for yourselves? I can't imagine you called yourselves gurus.
We did.
Did you really?
You called yourselves ruse.
Oh, ruse, okay.
I mean, or meditators, but, you know, yeah, I think it would be like, you know, oh, is he a Roo? Yeah, I would totally say that.
Claire Hoffman's our guest on The Exchange. Your book is Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood, which was spent at the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's Center in Fairfield, Iowa, built on a defunct campus of a college. Here's a call from Larry in Maine. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, hi, Claire. You know, I read your book, and I love it. My wife and I have been meditating for about 50 years, and we taught for 20 years, so we share a lot of those experiences and maybe even cross paths and so forth. But, you know, one thing I wanted to point out was in the early days of the movement when we were there in the 60s and 70s, you know, the Maharishi was sort of a sweet, nice guy, and everybody sort of, you know, they would challenge him and argue with him and, you know, tell him that he made mistakes, and it was a much more egalitarian and kind of a fun counterculture and anti-establishment situation, and we really enjoyed it. And then it got, as you know, probably got a little bit more weird and then got a little more hierarchical. And finally, when these guys were running around in these little capes and gold crowns, it was a little bit too much for us. But we still meditate. We still love it. So I thought I'd share that with you.
Thanks for the story, Larry. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, I tried to get that into my book because it's, you know, so many of these books that come out of people who are raised in these sort of fringe communities or fringe religions, it's like I was part of something totally crazy and I escaped. And I wanted the story to be different than that. And part of that was, you know, I love my mother and my friends and their parents growing up. Everybody had, like, the early days of the movement just sound like these incredible days. You know, I mean, people, you know, that had all this access to Maharishi, which really changed. And there was such a sense of purpose and excitement and energy. And, yeah, I really wanted that to be in the book of how good it felt and how really intelligent and smart people joined up, you know, and it made a lot of sense to them. It wasn't like, oh, these are just, you know, fools who got duped.
You did occasionally see people demonstrating outside the campus, didn't you?
I did, yeah. That was, it was always strange. And to be honest, they seemed like just total weirdos to me as a kid. You know, they'd be these sort of, we were in our sort of world peace bubble where we were meditating all the time, and you drive past these protesters on the edge of campus who were like enraged and angry, like with signs. And it was like, God, why are these people so mad? You know, like it just didn't make sense to us. But, you know, I understand that perspective a little more now.
Was it a response from people of other religions or just a general dislike of what they were, what they suspected was going on there?
I think the people that I saw around that time in the 80s, there were a number of lawsuits just saying, you know, some people saying that they felt like meditation was damaging, you know, that it was dangerous for certain people. It had been kind of marketed and sold as a cure-all for everybody, but, you know, some people were having really weird experiences and they felt like they were damaging. So there are people who felt angry about that, or, you know, or just duped in terms of like, hey, you said I was going to fly and I'm not flying. That one.
Right. You turned to your mother at one point, didn't you, and said, Mom, what's brainwashed mean?
Right, yeah. Yeah, and it sounded kind of cool to me, like, oh, that might feel good to have your brain get washed, but it was, you know, I mean, there are things afterwards that I think you question, but we were really disconnected from my mother's family or any family at all. You know, we didn't leave very often. And,
bit of, you know, a bubble then.
Yeah, it was definitely, we were sort of isolated. And part of that was, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, so we couldn't travel or go anywhere. But we were definitely kind of disconnected from the rest of the world.
Now, the Maharishi himself did come to campus, but it sounds like not often at all.
No, he came once. He probably came a few times in the 70s when the university was getting started, and once when I lived there in 1983, and sort of into the new year of 1984. And after that, he never came back. So it created, you know, it just sort of heightened this guru state where he was this faraway person who was issuing edicts and knowledge and philosophy, and it would be trickled down to the rest of us, you know, whoever had access to him, which was usually people who were donating on a large scale. They would bring back Maharishi's knowledge, and that knowledge would kind of trickle down. And being like a kid living in a meditator-only trailer park, I felt sort of at the bottom of that information trickle. So, you know, you'd be told, Maharishi said that you had to clean your room. Maharishi said that you had to wear your uniform differently, that lateness was a bad thing.
I don't know how much you've read about the Rajneeshis in Oregon, but, you know, part of what was their undoing, it would appear, was the inner circle that developed, that kind of enclosed Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. And was it that sort of thing, do you think, with the Maharishi?
I think somewhat. I mean, you know, it still exists today. I'm fascinated by the Rajneeshis because it does feel like, you know, the seed of the same idea that went in a totally different direction. But there are similarities. I mean, there's an interesting overlap in terms of a taste for luxury that I think is fascinating. But, yeah, I think the inner circle, I mean, what happens with so many of these spiritual figures is they get kind of isolated from the world around them. And part of that is all the adulation that is being thrown at them. But, you know, you have the inner circle, which are usually people who have, you know, entirely devoted their lives, but also people who are really donating a lot of money. And that dynamic does create a hierarchy, as your last caller, Larry, mentioned. You know, it got very hierarchical. Their names and special groups and access to Maharishi became very, very valuable.
Huh, you had to work your way up the chain, as it were.
Yes.
The book is called Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood. Claire Hoffman is our guest on The Exchange and its author. We'll come back and talk more with Claire and take more phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the journalist Claire Hoffman from Los Angeles. She's worked stints at Rolling Stone and the Los Angeles Times and has been published in many national publications. Now she's out with a memoir called Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood, after the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who set up a not a commune, but a campus on the campus of a defunct college in Iowa. Claire's family moved there when she was fairly little. And she spent years learning transcendental meditation, from age 3 forward. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe you have memories of that time in history or some experiences with meditation of your own that you'd like to share. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Tina in Humboldt County. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for having the author on today. I haven't read the book, but I am a transcendental meditator for over 20 years, and I just wanted to comment on how helpful it has been in my life and how grateful I am that the Maharishi came to the United States and was able to set up meditation centers across the United States to spread this very practical, pretty simple form of meditation, which is extremely powerful and helpful.
How much of each day, Tina, do you spend meditating?
Usually 30 minutes in the morning and sometimes 30 minutes in the evening. That's the prescribed amount, but the evening time I don't always get to do.
Mm-hmm. But it's done lots for you, it sounds like.
Oh, it's changed my life.
What turned you onto it in the first place, I wonder?
Well, I was taking a philosophy of meditation class. I was a religious studies major, and my the professor was a transcendental meditation teacher and was, a student of Maharishi's. And so I took the class, I learned about transcendental meditation, and decided I wanted to take the initiation, which at the time in 1992 cost $600, which was like $10,000 for me. But I'm so grateful I scraped together that $600. It changed my life forever.
All right. Thanks for the story, Tina. Very much appreciate that. Claire, well, I'm curious about you were talking about when you did finally get into the private school on campus in Iowa. How much of the stuff you learned in school was connected in some way to transcendental meditation?
You know, initially the idea was just to have a school where, a wonderful private school where, you know, you're meditating in the morning and in the afternoon, and the rest of the day is really just a school like any other, you know, with pursuing the subjects that everyone pursues. And over time, there was this, you know, as a kid, and this was happening, you know, in the community, it became more and more focused on Maharishi's philosophy of living. He had a philosophy called the Science of Creative Intelligence. And initially that was just one class that we took at the beginning of the day with the idea that the ideas would bleed through all subjects. But, you know, by the time I was in eighth grade, it felt like, you know, every class was an SEI class with just hints of earth science or math. But, you know, it really, his philosophy became ingrained in everything. You know, also, Jeff, I just want to say with the last caller, I mean, it's been an incredible part of this, writing this book is the letters I've gotten from people talking about how powerful meditation is and how thankful they are for Maharishi, which is something I feel too. You know, I mean, it completely shaped my life. And I think it's really interesting how people can kind of pick and choose. You know, it's such an American process these days in terms of religion and spirituality of saying, you know, I love the meditation. I'm not that interested in the man. You know, I'm thankful for him, but I'm not going to become his follower. But I will take the things of value that he has and leave the rest behind. And it's, you know, there's the majority of people who practice TM today are, you know, are like that.
You mentioned your mother's devotion to it. I haven't talked much about your older brother, Stacy. I mean, how much did he get into the package of beliefs that came with the Maharishi?
You know, my brother was a cool customer. He was rebellious and pretty cynical by the time he was a teenager as well. You know, I mean, I think disenchantment is really different for different people. And I think that's a thing to understand about our experience. And so many of the people that I've heard from are people who grew up in Fairfield, too, where, you know, we all believed in this incredible utopian vision, and that really fell apart, and that affects some people really powerfully in negative ways. You know, there's a lot of people who are really angry. You know, there's people who've turned to substances, and there's you know, been a spate of young people committing suicide there. You know, I mean, there's a nihilism that comes from having belief kind of fall apart.
Did it fall apart for a lot of people? I mean, you mentioned in the book that about the time that you saw demonstrators, that some cracks began to appear in the heaven on earth that you had experienced up to that point.
I would say by the late 90s, Maharishi died in 2008, and by the late 90s, things had become so rigid and so restrictive there, and in my opinion, very almost superstitious, that a lot of people, like my mother, who had been attracted to the meditation and who had a real love for Maharishi, but were kind of, you know, I don't want to say repulsed, but repulsed by the hierarchy that was forming around Maharishi and all the restrictions and the ideas of how to live that were coming out of his organization. And so they kind of moved on to other spiritual processes or whatever. They continued to meditate. They continued to live in Fairfield, but they weren't, you know, devotees in the truest sense of the word.
Was the idea of learning yogic flying the jump the shark moment for a lot of people?
I think so. I mentioned before that transcendental meditation has had these two big moments in, you know, sort of popular culture, and the other one is now, which is just fascinating for me to watch. So, you know, I mean, you've got the 60s and 70s when all these people are learning, you know, 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the afternoon, $35, really basic technique. And then, you know, you go to yoga flying and you lose a lot of people and it becomes this sort of orthodox, almost fundamentalist Vedic lifestyle for, you know, maybe three decades. I mean, there's, you know, Vedic City, Iowa still exists. There's still people pursuing that dream. But now, just in the last, you know, 8 years or so since Maharishi has died, transcendental meditation is back in a big way. And, you know, part of that is due to film director David Lynch, who's really evangelized the merits of transcendental meditation. And because of him, you know, you have all these big sort of famous people from Giselle to Rupert Murdoch to Sergey Brin to Elon Musk, you know, Ellen and Oprah. I mean, all these big name people who are practicing transcendental meditation and talking about it and talking about its benefits. And again, I feel like it's because this whole sort of chapter of orthodoxy and yogic flying has been kind of forgotten or pushed to the side.
David Lynch. Is he thinking of making a movie about Maharishi or anything?
No. I mean, it feels like a movie he would make, though, that he would suddenly...
With Kyle MacLachlan, of course.
Exactly, that he'd sort of unwittingly become a guru himself.
Right. Oh, that actually would be the...
Right?
That could be some fun. Yeah, you're right. It's interesting, too, because your reaction to your mother talking about yogic flying competitions was very similar to mine, because you mentioned it early in the book. It's like, I thought meditation was about not competing.
Right. That was your reaction to yoga flying. Yeah, no, it was totally bizarre. It didn't make any sense. But, I mean, Maharishi was a human, and so what you get out of this, you know, and I mean that, but like he was a man with his own sort of complicated lens on the world. So as much as we who lived in Fairfield thought that we were living this sort of perfect Vedic life, you know, exactly sort of from the texts of the Ved, a lot of it had to do with his personality, you know, like everyone wore pastel colors because he liked pastel colors. And you know, everything was gold. The buildings were gold. People were driving gold Camrys because he liked the color gold. And, you know, with yogic flying, that was sort of his sensibility. He did like competition. He did sort of believe in capitalism and that, you know, people who worked the hardest succeeded. And he had a lot of ideas like that that got kind of baked into the organization and into the town.
Do you resist the notion, though, that it was a cult? I mean, people were using the term back then and probably still use it now about what was going on in Iowa. Does it bother you?
It doesn't bother me. I understand the sort of desire to put a label on it. You know, it's another reason that I wrote this book is I feel like people really want a black or white, description of religion. It's true or it's false. You know, it's a cult or it's a faith. And it's an unrealistic divide to me. I mean, first of all, TM, you can just get on a plane and leave. So the idea of having to escape, which is sort of baked into this idea of a cult, mm-hmm. is not applicable there. So in that sense, it just doesn't make sense. But, you know, I mean, all these new religious movements have these funny things where people, you know, do tend to get isolated and do tend to, like, take these ideas and really run with them. But, you know, I think part of writing this book was exploring this idea of, like, you know, intelligent people believe really unusual things, and that belief really, you know, powers their actions, and it's a lens onto the world. So they see the world so differently when you believe strongly in these kind of unusual ideas.
Let's take another call. We have Nora in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Claire Hoffman.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. Sort of, I actually forked over the money and did take a lesson in TM and do it, you know, fairly frequently. But when I first looked into it, probably 20 years ago, they told us that if everybody meditated, then there would be world peace. And then they asked for $1,000, and that just kind of seemed, you know, if it would make world peace, then why didn't they just do it for free?
Okay, interesting question. Thanks for that, Nora. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm happy. I will answer that the way I can tell you what the TM organization would say. I'm not selling TM or suggesting anyone buy it. But, you know, there was a couple of ideas that Maharishi had. One was that Americans didn't value things unless they paid for them, so then everything was kind of expensive that he sold. And then, you know, I mean, what they would say now is that the price of learning to meditate goes towards teachers who work full-time, and that pays their salaries. And I find that kind of credible. I think, you know, you do have to have people make a living wage. I support that idea. As far as the world peace, that was part of the yogic flying idea, that it was this mathematical formula that Maharishi came up with called the Maharishi effect. And that said, according to him, that if 7% of, if the square root of the, oh God, I can't even remember, it's so complicated. Yeah, if 1% of the square root of the world's population practiced his advanced form of meditation, then there would be world peace.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting concept. So, I mean, ultimately, did you end up feeling that TM had made your life better? Were you able to deal better with the things that came along later in life once you'd kind of moved away? Well, you left, you said, at age 17. But did what you'd learned in Iowa stick with you in a way that helped you?
It did. You know, I mean, I meditate today. I meditate regularly. And my husband learned a couple of years ago out of his own desire. And my daughter, who's 6 now, learned when she was 4. And I do identify as a meditator, and I believe that meditation gives you sort of a space and, you know, a privacy in some ways from the kind of constant assault of the world around you. And it can make you feel more integrated and peaceful, all these things. I don't think it's a cure-all. I grew up with this idea that meditation would fix everything that was broken and that it was for everybody. And I think there's a million ways to pursue these same benefits. You know, I think if you go for a run for an hour, you're probably going to feel pretty incredible, too.
Mm-hmm. What's left of the operation in Iowa, Claire? I mean, is there still a TM center there, and is there still a Ruse versus Townies dichotomy?
Not so much the Ruse versus Townies. There's now the mayor of Fairfield is a meditator, and it's a much more integrated community. After whatever it is, 40 years, there's a certain peace that has settled in. And interestingly, the meditators have, through their sort of entrepreneurial spirit and the businesses that they brought in, given a financial boost to the town. So it's preserved that kind of quaint, small-town America way of life that, you know, probably in the 70s and 80s, the people living there were so worried about disappearing.
Huh, so they managed to save some of the old charm of the town.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Fairfield, Iowa is where a lot of the events take place. And Claire Hoffman's greetings from Utopia Park, surviving a transcendent childhood. Claire, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Jeff, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.